is Friday, February 21, 2014. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Ukraine is back in the news again, back in the international headlines, and in a big way and in a very tragic way. Just a matter of a couple of days ago, the government and protesters had agreed to what was declared to be a truce, but it fell apart yesterday when the government of President Viktor Yanukovych cracked down on protesters, leading to the deaths of what are counted to be dozens in the streets of Kiev alone. As many are now observing, this is not just a quasi-civil war, it is quickly becoming a civil war. And the main point is this: it's taking place largely under the sponsorship of the Russian government of President Vladimir Putin, and it's taking place just 600 miles from the Sochi Olympics. And so the international community is beginning to understand exactly what's going on here. Simultaneously, Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, is ordering his Ukrainian lackey to crack down on protesters, even at the point of spilling blood on the streets of Kiev, even as he is enjoying international adulation and attention for the 2014 Winter Olympics taking place in Sochi. And some are beginning to understand that he's about to get away with it. One protest to that particular development is coming from Bernard-Henri Lévy, a major French philosopher and public intellectual, who has published an article in English translation in yesterday's edition of the Wall Street Journal. As Mr. Lévy writes, quote, "There is in this overlay of images, in the nearly perfect concordance of the two ceremonies, that of the Olympic celebration in full swing and that of the funeral of the European dream for one of the peoples who still believed in it, something that insults the intelligence and breaks the heart," end quote. That's the philosopher's language for what's taking place in Sochi and in Kiev. In Sochi, he says, Vladimir Putin has put on a party with a massive opening ceremony that's going to be followed by an equally, if not greater, closing ceremony, all to the world's adulation. Meanwhile, the ceremony he references in Kiev is what he calls the funeral of the European dream. And as Mr. Lévy looks at the situation, he says that far too many people in the West believe there are two Vladimir Putins, a good Vladimir and a bad Vladimir. But as he says, there's really only one, and it's the bad Vladimir Putin. Bernard-Henri Lévy is one of the most influential intellectuals in France, and that should tell us something, because as he's writing about the situation in Russia, he's writing about the funeral of this European dream, a dream that he believes is in danger not only in Kiev, but anywhere the Europeans allow it to die. He calls upon Western leaders, including the president of his own country, to show some moral backbone by withdrawing the athletes from the 2014 Winter Olympics, or, at the very least, by leaving and going before the closing ceremonies. He writes, "A suggestion for François Hollande and Barack Obama, the presidents of two permanent members of the United Nations Security Council, an urgent convocation of the Security Council should be prompted by those deaths in Europe. These hundreds of wounded people, hounded by special troops, who, as we know from observers on the ground, will stop at nothing. Does not this provocation, this cold crime so confidently committed, justify at least a formal notice to the Ukrainian regime and its Kremlin patron?" He also issued a plea to the Olympic committees of neighboring nations. He writes, "And finally, a plea to the Olympic committees of the nation's president, Sochi, who plod on as if nothing were amiss, deaf and blind to the tragedy unfolding a few hundred kilometers away. At these games, where the flame symbolizing the Olympic ideal has been purloined by a thug, when the winning athletes playfully bite their medals, this time will not the gold, silver, and bronze have the metallic taste of blood? Do you have a thought for that other snow, the bloody snow, the snow that, make no mistake, is front and center in the thoughts of your home?" Host. Also yesterday, the New York Times came out with a major article by Stephen Lee Myers, once again suggesting that what we are seeing here is a reappearance of the Cold War that many people thought was long over. And as evidence of this, Mr. Myers points to the fact that the propping up of the Ukrainian regime by the Russians is being counteracted upon by the support of Europe by the Americans, the European ideal that is present in the political aspirations of so many within Ukraine. As if all that's not troubling enough, Wednesday's edition of USA Today featured an article by Doug Stanglin and Anya Aryatunyan, in which the two reporters detail how the Russian government is going to extreme lengths to try to protect its version of the nation's history. As they write, Russian authorities are growing increasingly testy over how the country's past, particularly World War II, is publicly depicted, and some legislators are backing a law that would bar negative portrayals of Russian history. End quote. You heard that right. Russian legislators are considering a law that would make it illegal to say anything negative about Russia's history. And anyone who knows anything about Russian history knows that there's a great deal of negative there. One lawmaker trying to pass this kind of law said, quote, "Our history and our point of view on historical events are being distorted in Russia and abroad." That was said by Alexei Pushkov, who is head of the State Duma Foreign Policy Committee. Others have said similar things. Pushkov, by the way, also made this comment. When there's such a battle for history going on, when EU, that is, European Union, countries pass laws protecting a certain point of view of history, maybe it's time for us to think about legislation that will protect our history and our point of view. End quote. Russia is growing increasingly sensitive, or at least increasingly assertive, about its sensitivities. As the USA Today piece records, the Russian Foreign Ministry reprimanded CNN for a story on unattractive monuments that called a Soviet war monument in Brest ugly and said some people think the soldier looks constipated. CNN, by the way, apologized and re-edited the piece, even though the soldier still has the same look on his face. Needless to say, there's a great deal of insecurity on the part of a nation that would complain about a cable news network in a different country reporting that one of its war monuments in a smaller town within the country had a soldier that the network said looked constipated. If you're willing to make something of that nature an official complaint by your foreign ministry, something's amiss. The USA Today piece concludes with these words, "Russians have complex attitudes toward their own history. About half the population, 49%, has a positive view of Soviet leader Joseph Stalin, who presided over World War II and a purge that saw millions of people killed," according to a 2013 survey conducted by the Levada Center. Historian Boris Kargulitsky says lots of people on the left and the right see Stalin as a tough leader, quote, "who got things done," end quote. Well, of course, Stalin was a leader who got things done. Of course, one of the things that Joseph Stalin got done was a pact, a secret pact with Adolf Hitler that was fully in effect until Adolf Hitler pulled a fast one and turned on Joseph Stalin. Only at that point did Stalin become an ally of the Western powers, and a very awkward ally at that. Every time Joseph Stalin sat with Allied leaders such as Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill, he sat as a mass murderer. After all, Joseph Stalin is directly credited with one of the most massive death counts in the very bloody 20th century, amounting almost certainly to tens of millions of people during his bloody dictatorship. From a Christian worldview perspective, what this affirms perhaps more than anything else is the reality that history is a part of our identity. Every single nation, every single people has a history, and that history becomes definitional in terms of how we understand ourselves to exist now, who we are, and where we are headed. History is used by some peoples to blame their current reality on injustices inflicted upon them from the past. That's largely the reality throughout the Arab world today, at least the Muslim world in particular. Some nations think of their history as essentially tragic, others as generally glorious, and both of those have major impact upon how people think about themselves now and how they envision their future. God made us not only creatures made in His image, but creatures in His image who have an understanding of chronology, who cannot but think in terms of past and present and future. And the battle over the past is never merely an academic issue. It's a battle over identity. And as this issue in Russia makes clear, it is a battle over morality as well. Furthermore, when we fast forward to the 2014 Winter Olympics and we put them into context, it was clear from the very beginning that Vladimir Putin wanted to change the way the world sees Russia, not only in the present and not only in the future, but also in the past, in terms of how it conducted the 2014 Winter Games. Bernard-Henri Levy is exactly right. If Putin gets away with this, shame on the rest of the world, because the world knows that what's taking place right now in Kiev is directly traceable to the same man wearing his fur coat, smiling in the stands at the 2014 Sochi Olympics. By the way, just before we leave Russia, the Wall Street Journal over the weekend reported that the probability that a Russian man will die before he turns 55, that's age 55, is now 25%. Why? Two major studies in Russia are demonstrating that the answer is attributable to one word, and that word is vodka. As the Wall Street Journal reports, Russian men tend to drink their vodka uncut, that is absolutely straight. Quote, "they also tend to drink until they are drunk and then continue drinking," end quote. This kind of behavior points to a deep worldview crisis, indeed what many understand to be a deep spiritual crisis within Russia. When you have Russian men by this kind of number, numbering in the tens of millions, drinking themselves to death, with a quarter of them dying of vodka drinking before they reach the age of 55, clearly there is something horribly wrong in this country. The death rate among young men in Russia is now that either meets or exceeds many of the most dangerous countries in the world today. The Russian men aren't dying by accident, they're dying by alcohol. And that tells us also a very great deal about what's going on in Russia today. Shifting to the issue of abortion, major statistical information is now available to us, comparing the rates of abortion not only nationwide but state by state, comparing the year 2000 and the year 2010. There is a glimmer of good news in this report. Over that 10-year period, the percentage rate of abortions dropped at least somewhat in this country and in most states as well. In one of those states, Tennessee, the abortion rate dropped about 6% in those years between 2000 and 2010. But something even more interesting appears in the statistics from the state of Tennessee. As the National Tennessean reports, what increased vastly during that decade were the number of women gaining abortions in Tennessee but coming from neighboring states. Right now, during that period, that decade, 2000 to 2010, and continuing to the present, approximately 25%, that's one quarter of all the abortions conducted in Tennessee, are from women who do not live in Tennessee. Even as the total percentage of abortions in Tennessee dropped during that decade, there was a 30% increase in the number of out-of-state women seeking abortions in the state. This has led at least some Tennessee lawmakers to express the fear that the state is becoming what is called a, quote, abortion destination, end quote. Thus, there is an amendment that is now proposed for the Tennessee Constitution. It's known as Amendment 1, that would eliminate abortion protections from the Tennessee Constitution. The Tennessean also reported that the breakdown of abortions within the state of Tennessee comes down to this, quote, while non-white Tennesseans constitute just 70% of all state residents, non-white women were more likely to obtain abortions than white women. Non-white women obtained 6,294 abortions in 2012 versus 5,376 sought by white women within the state. In other words, the majority of abortions were undertaken by a minority of the population. With over 50%, indeed well over 50% of all the abortions, experienced by at least just 17% of all the residents of the state. There was other truly very fascinating information included in the article. For instance, in a breakdown by marital status, 9% of the marital status was unknown, but of the women seeking abortions over that decade in Tennessee, 15% were identified as married, 77% as unmarried. That tells you something about what happens when sex and reproduction are separated from marriage. Abortion, it turns out, as is documented in these statistics, is an inevitable result where abortion is made possible and legal, and furthermore, often paid for by governments or others. Then you look at the fact that the number of previous abortions undertaken by women, as reported, 57% of the abortions were on women who were having their first abortion. But 24%, that's one quarter almost, of all the abortions undertaken in Tennessee in this decade were from women who were seeking a second abortion. 4% were seeking a third abortion, and 3% a fourth or greater number of abortions. Sadly, for at least some people, abortion is becoming a routine means of birth control, something that is almost so horrifying that it's hard to imagine, but it's right here in the statistics. Meanwhile, just across Tennessee's southern border, the Times Daily in Alabama, representing northwest Alabama, had a headline news article yesterday entitled Abortion is a Hot Topic at the Capitol, the capital being, of course, the city of Montgomery. As Mary Sell for the Times Daily reports, a committee of lawmakers in the Alabama House heard alternating arguments Wednesday about reducing abortions in Alabama and staying out of women's choices. Four bills that would put new regulations on what must be done before abortions can be performed were discussed in public hearings in the House Health Committee, drawing emotional responses from both sides. One of the bills would require a 48-hour wait. The representative behind that bill is Representative Ed Henry, a Republican of Hartsel, and he said that it's very important that women have 48 hours to think about what an abortion would mean. And very, very poignantly within this article, it is demonstrated that Representative Henry knows exactly what he's talking about, because he admitted in this article that at an earlier point in his life, he took his girlfriend to an abortion clinic to get an abortion. He told the paper, quote, we hear a lot of people say women already know, but I have to disagree. I think there are a lot of women who don't know the alternatives or the consequences of abortion, end quote. Meanwhile, speaking against Representative Henry's point was Joanne Cummings, identified as a resident of the Alabama city of Decatur. She said, quote, "You need to get out of our bedrooms and leave these decisions where they belong, between a woman, her partner, her physician, and her God," end quote. A very interesting statement. She says that the legislators need to get out and leave these decisions, in her words, where they belong. She says they belong in a zone of privacy that would include only the woman, her partner, she says, her physician, and her God, end quote. Well, what's missing from all of that is the understanding that every society establishes its value on human life and then codifies that in legislation. There is not one society on earth, nor has there ever been, that takes no stand whatsoever on the issue of the definition of human life and the requirement to protect the human lives that are recognized and given the status of law. The statement made by this woman indicates that the unborn child has no standing in her moral decision-making whatsoever. But the big question for the society, of course, is whether or not the society at large will recognize any sense of dignity and sanctity of life for that unborn child. That's what's now being debated in the Alabama House. That's what's being debated in many legislatures around this country. That's what's being argued about in terms of our national conversation on abortion. And even though it frustrates many people, that is not a private conversation. It's a public conversation because, after all, it's a matter of public law. Meanwhile, addressing the issue of same-sex marriage, Time reporter Michael A. Lindenberger writes for Time magazine that the recent decisions made by federal judges in Kentucky and Virginia could, quote, ripple across the South, end quote. As he points out, until 2 weeks ago, not one state in the South had any kind of legal momentum toward same-sex marriage. But all that changed in the matter of just a few days, when shortly before Valentine's Day, a judge in Kentucky and then a judge in Virginia voted to strike down those states' constitutional amendments against same-sex marriage. As he writes, quote, "The South is home to some of the deepest objections to gay marriage in the nation. Every state in the region, save Maryland, explicitly bans legal same-sex unions. Until last week, no federal judge or top state court there had ever ruled in favor of gay marriage. And 11 years ago, when Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote the landmark opinion Lawrence v. Texas, striking down anti-sodomy laws in 14 states where it was still illegal to have gay sex, 8 of those states were in the South," end quote. And yet, as he writes, all that is changing, and it's changing fast. Michael Klarman, a professor at the Harvard Law School, said, quote, "If you took a referendum in Virginia today, it would turn out in favor of gay marriage," end quote. In Kentucky, just before the federal judge in Louisville struck down the constitutional amendment, the local Bluegrass state poll indicated that the percentage of Kentuckians supporting same-sex marriage was now approximately 45%. That's up from a decade ago when it was only about 26%. After an interview, Mr. Lindenberger quoted me within his article, and he quoted me to the point that we are witnessing a fundamentally changed cultural moment, and the fact that I said there is a sense of inevitability in these cases, and I stand by that comment. In a very interesting addition to the article, Mr. Lindenberger gets to the fact that the rapid expansion of legal same-sex marriage in this country is demonstrated by the fact that in just 1 year, that's the previous year, 2013, in one sense, almost everything changed. To that point, he cites Professor Arthur Leonard, a professor at New York Law School and an expert, he says, on gay rights, quote, "The tide of history is moving and indeed accelerating. During 2013, the number of jurisdictions in which same-sex couples could marry more than doubled and is now close to 40% of the country, where 40% lives in such jurisdictions. In addition, public opinion," he says, "continues to move in support of allowing same-sex couples to marry," end quote. It is very important to recognize that even at the end of 2013, approximately 4 in 10 Americans already lived where same-sex marriage was legal. And it's even more important to recognize the velocity of the moral revolution we are currently experiencing, where in just 1 year, the year 2013, the number of jurisdictions with legal same-sex marriage doubled. Finally, even as worldviews matter, so do waistlines. An article in the Financial Times indicates that China now has a problem. Its soldiers have been growing because they're eating better and they're not getting so many childhood diseases. And as Chinese soldiers are growing, they're not fitting into Chinese tanks anymore. As Charles Clover from Beijing reports, China already has the largest army in the world. Now its soldiers are getting bigger, too. A People's Liberation Army study has concluded that its soldiers are significantly taller and fatter than they were 20 years ago, so much so that they're in danger of outgrowing their equipment, end quote. At the same time, the Financial Times reported this article, making the point that these Chinese soldiers are having difficulty fitting into their tanks. It points out that China is involved in international saber-rattling and is worrying many of the countries around it. Well, maybe they don't need so much to fear the Chinese soldiers as to feed them. As I close, let me remind you about tomorrow's upcoming release of the new installment of Ask Anything Weekend Edition. Our new podcast is released every Saturday morning. We'd also want to have your question. Call us with your question and your voice at 877-505-2058. That's 877-505-2058. This morning at 9 o'clock, I'll be preaching at Grace Life Church in Muscle Shoals, Alabama. I'll be preaching at the church's annual True Church Conference. That's at 9 o'clock this morning. If you're in the region of Muscle Shoals, Alabama, or Northwest Alabama, I'd love to see you there. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'm speaking to you from Muscle Shoals, Alabama, and I'll meet you again on Monday for The Briefing.